On January 27th, the South Korean government, in concert with private biotech companies, went into overdrive to produce effective testing kits for the coronavirus. There were, at the time, only 4 cases in the country, but the gravity of the crisis was quickly understood. 7 weeks later, South Korea had tested well over 290,000 people and identified over 8,000 cases. As a result, there have been a reduction in new cases in March. South Korea's actions contrast from those of the United States government. Only 60,000 tests have been run as of March 18th. There are, of course, 330 million people in the country. As a result of these insufficient tests, there is no way of knowing how many cases there are in the United States, and an effective containment policy is difficult to craft. One projection estimated that as many as 96 million people could be infected in the coming months. Why was there such a huge difference between the responses from South Korea and the United States? And what can the world do together to address this crisis? Our guests today highlight that it was not just technical capacity, but political leadership and civic engagement that played a huge role in shaping South Korea's response. With no further delay, from the Korea Economic Institute in self-isolation, I'm your host, Yang Kwon, and you're listening to Korean Context. We have with us today KEI President and CEO Kathleen Stevens and Vice President Mark Tokola. Both are veteran U.S. foreign policy officers who have firsthand experience with how countries respond to international crises. Kathleen Stevens was the U.S. ambassador to South Korea during the 2009 H1N1 outbreak, and Mark Tokola was stationed in the U.S. Embassy in London during the G20 summit in the United Kingdom that coordinated a response to the global financial crisis. Thank you both for being on Korean Context.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Ambassador Stevens, if I may start with you, there's been a lot of praise of the South Korean response to the coronavirus, from their drive-through testing facilities to apps that let people know where they could purchase masks. But is this what the international community should take away as the key policy lesson from South Korea's experience?
I think a lot of the praise that South Korea is getting for its response is well-deserved and justified. And you mentioned a couple of the very creative innovations they've made to try to address it. But I think the larger lesson that I think we can continue to try to learn from and draw from is that democracies can do this. But when democracies do this, it can look pretty noisy and it can be one step forward and two steps back. And you know, South Korea has not been seamless in its approach to this, but I think it's drawn from previous experiences, which we can certainly talk about. But it's also drawn from the hard political, I think, experience that South Korea has had as a self-described, very polarized environment where sometimes trust in political leadership is lacking. But in that environment, I think at the political level, the leaders decided early on, we're going to put it out there. We're going to be transparent. A lot of talk about what that means, but we're going to put the facts out as we know them, and we're going to have an active conversation with our citizens. And I think that's what has happened over the last month and a half, when they have certainly had their ups and downs, but it has helped to build the kind of foundation of trust and confidence to try new things and to implement policies that have turned out to be effective.
And it seems like the media has been using South Korea and Italy as opposing examples of successful and unsuccessful attempts to contain the coronavirus. South Korea, of course, being an example of a successful containment of the coronavirus. You mentioned earlier that South Korea has learned from past experiences. What are some of these experiences that you mentioned?
Well, some of the experiences are specifically with prior public health crises, the SARS epidemic, the H1N1, which occurred while I was living in Korea as ambassador about 10 years ago. But there have also been crises of other kinds. Some people will recall that the previous president, the current president, of course, is Moon Jae-in, but his predecessor, Park Geun-hye, really lost office in an unfolding scandal that really started with the loss of public confidence and trust that happened in the aftermath of a terrible tragedy involving a ferry sinking and many high school students dying. So completely different set of circumstances. But the diagnosis from that was that the government had not only not been effective in its response, but that it had not been forthcoming with the facts. And so I think that there's a sense in the Korean body politic across the board that they have a very sophisticated, very demanding citizenry. It's very well connected, not only through traditional media, but through digital media with all the rumors and conspiracy theories and everything come with that, that they're going to have to be very proactive in putting things out there. And I think that was a very hard-won lesson at the political level, but accompanied by the building in of some preparation on the technical side of not only what do you do in terms of public health response, but what do you do in terms of communications. Koreans are very proud of their hard-won democracy. They're very proud of their hard-won economic success. But I think they also have a sense that they've got to show that they can do this. And I think that that leads to the people to have very high expectations of their government. I would also say it is a very, and I don't know where this gets into contrast with other democracies, but it is a highly centralized and concentrated government that has probably some advantages and some disadvantages from a public policy point of view. Early on in February, when the central government thought it kind of had it under control, and then suddenly there was this big outbreak in a somewhat self-contained population in a provincial city, this church that had not cooperated with the central government's measures and threatened a real outbreak. But then the government was able to react quickly enough to respond to that and to, again, get back on a course where it seems like they are now able to be on a path to containment.
And speaking of other countries' examples, of course, a lot of people in the United States have pointed to South Korea's universal healthcare system. But again, other European countries also have universal healthcare. For instance, Italy provides universal healthcare to its citizens. It does not seem to have had as much success as South Korea in containing the virus. Are there things beyond the healthcare system that you were quite impressed by in terms of South Korea's coordination?
Yes, the way that they were able to very quickly, and again, I think it was based on some past experience in other circumstances, but very quickly tap into various forms of data, including that carried on your cell phone. Now, this raises, and it has been raised in Korea, a lot of questions of how do you balance that with people's privacy. But they use their highly connected population, the fact that not just smartphone penetration, but internet speeds, everything else are kind of at the highest and fastest in the world, to quickly make that a way of identifying those who might have been exposed, those who might have been at risk, and then trace their movements and follow up on that. So it was a combination of the public health capability, but that alone, I think, was not enough. It was the ability to quickly implement an ability to identify those most at risk and make sure that they were addressed, but done in a way which did not require the massive quarantining of people in cities.
As we've seen in, say, China or other areas. Mr. Tokola, switching gears a little bit, South Korea cannot stem this pandemic on their own. Even if South Korea contains this disease domestically, it is a trading power that relies on other countries being healthy enough, in this case not only economically but also literally, to engage in international commerce. As we briefly mentioned earlier, you were in London as part of the U.S. Foreign Service when the G20 nations met to coordinate a response to the financial crisis. You noted in some of your writing and speeches that this didn't happen automatically. Who were some of the key actors that really led the way in 2009?
In 2008, the financial problems were piling up kind of during the year, but the real crisis broke on September 15th, 2008, when Lehman Brothers collapsed. So we saw that in London because that's where their headquarters was, and so we saw it very directly. So at that point, after September 15th, there were a group of world leaders who decided that international response was needed. Because although the problem was specifically in the U.S. and in Europe, it was affecting the entire global economy. So it was actually five people that decided that there should be a world meeting. It was French President Sarkozy, Commission President Barroso, Balkan Enda, who was Prime Minister of the Netherlands, Kevin Rudd from Australia, and Gordon Brown, who was Prime Minister of the U.K., So five of them asked George Bush to convene a summit in Washington, D.C. to try to come up with a global response. And that was held in November of 2008, exactly 2 months after the crisis. So it was organized quite quickly. And the point of the Washington G20 meeting was to agree there should be an international coordinated response and to try to come up with a common diagnosis of the problem. And they also agreed that they would act quickly to take steps. And that led to the London summit, which was in April of 2009. So during that 5 months, Gordon Brown traveled around the capitals to try to canvass opinion. Angela Merkel called together the finance ministers in Germany for a meeting to talk about financial coordination. So some groundwork was done, but it happened quite quickly, and it was not a U.S. initiative that was asked of us to do to lead that. Where Hank Paulson was the Treasury Secretary, and Paulson and President Bush acted to try to create some stimulus packages to try to get the U.S. economy confident and moving again, but with a transition time. So when Barack Obama took over after the election 2008, he was the one that came to London for the April summit. And Geithner was a Treasury Secretary. It was actually Tim Geithner and his German counterpart who picked the countries that would attend the London meeting. So it wasn't just the G20. They also invited Spain and the Netherlands. And the World Bank, IMF, UN were all there too. And so it was more of an international gathering. But what was remarkable during that time was the decision was made among the G20 to not have a scripted summit. So the London summit was actually a working group. At that meeting, they actually negotiated what they're going to do and what their steps would be. So in London, we actually didn't know what people were going to say when they got together in the room. Obama actually walked through the corridors. There were lots of bilaterals, trilaterals, quadrilaterals, and the world leaders hammered out a package.
Was there anything that the U.S. Foreign Service did or what the White House did in particular that made the G20 in the end be so successful in stemming the financial crisis?
Nice mix of preparation and then spontaneity. Because, like I said, the finance ministers met in Germany, and they did have some ideas that were forwarded. Countries didn't necessarily agree what to do when they would meet in April. So you had some preparation, some ideas were on the table, but it was actually the spontaneous meetings of the heads of government that led them to make compromises, that led to a very, very energetic package. You know, at the end of the London summit, the world leaders had agreed to strengthen world trade, not to go protectionist. They agreed to double the amount of money given to the International Monetary Fund to help countries deal with the crisis. They agreed to regulate the international credit rating agencies. So very concrete steps were taken, and they were all hammered out kind of on the ground.
There are certain discussions happening between world leaders in response to the coronavirus outbreak. In particular, French President Emmanuel Macron appears to be playing a more active role in pushing the United States and other major powers to hold conferences and to attempt to pool resources for a response. But is this something that a country like France can really do on their own?
The parallel is interesting because, like I said, in 2008, it was actually Sarkozy from France that was one of the leaders of trying to get an international response put together. France is underestimated in the U.S. as a country because we don't speak their language. We tend to overestimate the U.K. a little bit because we read The Economist and listen to BBC and The Guardian and The Observer. But France has a big role to play in trying to help move the international community along. This time, Macron just picked up the torch that Sarkozy was carrying before to try to help lead an international response. It's odd because the U.S. is the chair of the G7 right now. The President Trump should have convened the G7, but it's evident that he didn't do that until he was pushed to do it by Macron.
You know, I just wanted to add, Young, too, to what Mark said. He's talking about when the financial crisis crested in September of 2008 with the collapse of Lehman Brothers. And I will call that day because it happened to be the day that I got off the plane in Seoul to arrive as the new American ambassador there. And what I found in Seoul was a country that was wondering, was it going to go through a repeat of the experience of a decade earlier of the Asian financial crisis when the South Korean economy kind of went belly up and had a big IMF rescue and very scarred by that. In the event, things went relatively well for South Korea in the period following the financial crisis. And one big reason was actually the G20, which was, as Mark described, kind of a brand new grouping of countries that expanded beyond the G7, brought in countries like the Republic of Korea and from other continents that were not traditional great powers, but were substantial and important world players, middle powers, and substantial economies. And in fact, South Korea took the chair of the G20 the following year. In addition to the work that the G20 did, this really gave a sense, not only for South Korea, but for other similar middle powers who brought a lot to bear and had, you know, so much at stake in this global crisis, since they had a seat at the table. And I think effective far beyond what even diplomats who were dedicated to the idea of diplomacy and even multilateral diplomacy thought was possible. I think it is really one of the less appreciated stories coming out of that period for the United States and the great powers, but also for middle powers like South Korea.
That's exactly right. In the 1990s, the idea of a G20 was kind of kicking around with the Asian financial crisis, but it didn't really get going until the 2008 crisis. But it was talked about. And the idea was G7 was not big enough to deal with all the problems that were in the world because other countries mattered. China and South Korea and the middle powers, Australia. So Lee Myung-bak was one of the leaders that came to London. And South Koreans then chaired the G20 the following year and did a remarkably good job of pulling together the next G20 meeting. They played a very important role.
Ambassador Stevens, you have written about the lack of international coordination in response to the coronavirus and noted that global institutions and ties have been found wanting. Could you elaborate on why this might be, even with existence of international institutions like the World Health Organization and also the G20? Why has coordination been so lacking in response to the coronavirus?
Well, that is, you know, one of the, I guess, the big questions of our time. And I guess the obvious way to answer it, and I think obvious because there's a lot of truth to it, is we're clearly in a period where there's been a lack of confidence and a lack of belief in the efficacy and the relevance of some of these international institutions, particularly the kind of the global ones. And we've seen, again, in every part of the world, a rise of a sense of let's look after our own first, let's secure our borders. I mean, whether it's in Europe or the United States or the rest of the world. And of course, with a Trump administration that came to power with that kind of thought, and I think has basically not really engaged as was done in the past in some of these institutions. So I think there has been a bit of atrophy. And I think what we saw in the initial stages of this pandemic, the current one, is the initial reaction was, let's try to secure our borders. I mean, that was also true in Asia. I mean, one of the first things that the South Koreans did do was make some decisions about who was coming and going, just as the U.S. did. And one decision they made is they were going to continue to allow, for example, most Chinese to continue to visit, although they had created some restrictions. That was heavily criticized and still is criticized by some in South Korea, particularly from the opposition party, who thought if they'd done that earlier, they could have, I mean, these are one of the counterfactuals now, they would have gotten an earlier hold on it. So I think we've seen that kind of debate and tension in every country, even those who, let's say, remain a little more devoted to the notion of these multilateral institutions. But I think this is one thing which I hope will kind of step back and look and think that, you know, even in this period of, to put it as mildly as I can, kind of readjustment of political ideologies and norms across the world, that we will see not just the advantages, but the demand to have some degree of international coordination and cooperation to deal with problems that do not respect borders, that require that kind of global coordination. But I do think it is one of the really glaring things about this crisis that, in particular, the United States was very slow off the mark in responding, and not only domestically, but in the notion that this is actually something that we need to work with other countries on and work on in a way that's something other than simply saying we're going to stop flights or stop trade or stop whatever we're going to stop.
I'll add to that. It's remarkable what's happened now with the lack of global coordination of leadership. A pandemic is, by definition, a global problem. It cries out for international coordination. And the U.S. is the chair of the G7 this year. This would have been the absolute perfect time for the U.S. to step up, pull the G7 together, and do something. So the fact that we didn't do that is striking. We took the French president to urge the U.S. president to convene the G7. And also the fact that our Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, as far as I can see, has said nothing about the pandemic publicly.
I think he said something today, but I haven't heard what it is. But that's after a long silence, yes.
Yeah, so it's remarkable the Secretary of State is silent on this issue.
So I think gradually, you know, we are seeing, you know, WHO people turning to some of these phone calls for the G7, but it is a bit too little too late. But we're still in many ways at just the beginning of the global implications of this, even if the efforts to contain the pandemic go relatively well. The economic fallout of this is going to continue for a long time, and it's still very uncertain, but very, very serious. I mean, this is the kind of issue that I would think that, again, the G20 finance ministers, certainly the leaders themselves, really begin to use these institutions, and G20 would seem like the logical one to me, to really begin to have a conversation with each other about what steps can be taken to anticipate and deal with the serious supply chain issues, financial issues, all the other things that we're already beginning to see fall out from this crisis.
There's supposed to be a G20 summit in November. That's a long time to wait.
Yeah.
Mr. Tokola, you mentioned the need for coordinated global response, and we have seen a lot of uncoordinated action when it comes to travel restrictions imposed by one country against another. Very recently, Japan imposed some travel restrictions on Korean travelers, which appears to have caught the South Korean government by surprise. And this is a great example of an area where there doesn't seem to be a lot of coordinated action. But in an ideal world where perhaps the United States is taking a more forward-leaning position on taking leadership on coordinating policy, what other public health measures would you like to see coordinated by the United States, by the G7, or by the G20?
I think the G20 is the right institution. The G7 should be meeting to discuss coordination, but the G20 would be the right place to have this kind of a coordinated response. It could be similar to what happened in 2008 and 2009 again, where the G20 met and they had a common diagnosis. They described the problem as they jointly saw it. And importantly, they said, but they were not new. They said that in both Washington and London, they would not engage in protectionism. They would not try to reduce trade or raise barriers to trade, because they thought part of the solution to the international economic crisis was to keep trade moving, not obstruct it. So it was a joint statement of what they would not do as well as what they would do. And it seems to apply in that way, too, to closing borders or dealing with the pandemic. Even if it's necessary, they should be doing it as a group and not trying to unilaterally or in a surprising way.
Ambassador Stevens, you mentioned that there's more than just the public health issues that the world has to grapple with, including the economic implications and also the other wide-ranging consequences of what this pandemic has done to the international community. Given this insight, when the world recovers from, say, the coronavirus, once the number of patients have gone down, what do you feel is needed? What should the world be doing once that happens?
As I mentioned, I think that we need to start not just within our own political systems, and I know that's happening now in Congress in the United States, but we really need to look at what are the short, medium, and long-term impact of this on our economies. And I was going to say kind of our politics, if you like. I think there are lots and lots of lessons to be learned about this. But the broader one, to stick with kind of the international theme, is what can we learn from each other? And I think there's been a lot of really interesting coverage in the United States on the experience in other countries, China, Korea, Italy, and so on. But I still see in some of that, well, you know, it may be easier for a country where somehow things are more authoritarian. I'm not sure that's the case. I don't think as we come out of this that the lesson is going to be, and I hope it's not, that somehow you've got to take away people's rights or abuse human rights or give up some of your freedoms in order to deal effectively with some of the global challenges that we're going to face again, like pandemics. And the values that I hope that we share with South Korea of encouraging creativity and openness and debate and so on, that is what has underpinned some of the successful South Korean responses. I mean, again, not only in getting compliance, but in coming up with creative solutions that we can, as countries who share and want to spread some values of greater openness, can use this as a pivot point, if you like, to move in that direction rather than in the direction that I think over the past couple of years, people have feared the world is going to, of one that's a little bit more nationalistic, a little bit more attracted to a kind of authoritarian, strongman, you know, kind of model. So that really is my hope and expectation that as we get through this, that we will feel strengthened, I think, in some of our values, but find a more practical way to realize them, if you like.
Now, we spoke a little bit about South Korea's response, the transparency and also the responsiveness of the South Korean government. And I turn this question to both you, Mr. Tokola, and Ambassador Stevens, but are there other countries besides South Korea that the United States can benchmark to better address a future crisis?
There's two sides to it. First is the testing side, and the second is the responsiveness side. And we could look at both those examples. South Korea has been the world leader in testing in terms of tests per million people. So that's very important. In a pandemic, knowing where the cases are and seeing how they're spreading is absolutely key to being able to deal with it. You know, by contrast, I looked at the World Health Organization dashboard this morning. It shows that Russia claims to have 93 cases. I don't believe that for a second. So either they're not testing or they're not telling people what the results are. But that's not transparent, and that's not good behavior by an authoritarian to grapple with the problem. So testing is important. Being able to have that capability and being able to start quickly and move quickly is a model for all of us. The country has done it really well. Been South Korea and Switzerland, Austria, Belgium, Hong Kong has done very well with that. And Italy, too. Italy did a lot of testing. Italy tested over 2,000 people per million, where the U.S. has been testing about 30 per million so far. So you can't fault Italy for the testing. The second part is responsiveness, what governments do when they know the information and how they act. So South Korea did really well with this, so did Belgium. They decided early on to close restaurants and bars. They were implementing programs of social distancing very early on, and that's helped keep the number of cases down in the country. So again, it doesn't take authoritarianism, it just takes the government to be able to give people clear guidance on what to do.
Other places that have done a good job, Taiwan, Singapore, what I would say they have in common is value has been attached to expertise and been, you know, well-developed civil servants who are putting in place some of the preparatory steps that you need for a crisis like this. And the U.S. has had this. The CDC is a world leader. But I think that one of the things, rather than even benchmarking, is to think about how do we take some of our own institutions, our proud institutions, and our great experts here, and make sure that they do not become, as I fear has happened, perhaps we're seeing now, a little bit hollowed out, or we became a little bit complacent, but draw some best practices from elsewhere, but really just reinforce our own commitment to having that kind of expert-led leadership. As I mentioned earlier, I actually think there's been some really interesting insights in the reporting that's been done, and I think it's the first time in a long time I've seen a lot more about South Korea in American press than I have about North Korea. And even though it's obviously a very serious situation still, it's impressive to see reporting that has really reflected on how South Korea stepped up. I guess it would just be for us as Americans to recognize that there's creativity and entrepreneurship in a lot of different places in the world. And I guess rather than specify some of the really fascinating things I certainly would never have thought about, how to use social media, how to create testing centers, you know, how to motivate people and reach people. But we can all be stimulated by those things. But to keep in mind that this has happened, as I mentioned at the beginning, in a political environment in South Korea that South Koreans themselves describe as deeply polarized. And in fact, where the political noise is very high. I think there is sometimes a stereotype that East Asian nations, you know, the order comes out and everybody kind of falls in place. That's certainly not the case in South Korea. You have to win people's trust, and then you have to win it again and win it again. So I would hope people would know that what South Korea has achieved or is achieving is very hard won and is being accomplished in a political atmosphere where political trust is actually rather low. That's possible to do, but it's possible to do by doing some of the things they've done, which is, again, to rely on entrepreneurs and experts from inside and outside the government and to communicate with great honesty and openness, even when the facts can be a bit disturbing and not the narrative you'd like to have.
Mr. Tokola, you have the last word. Is there anything that worries you in particular? Or alternatively, is there something that the U.S. government is doing particularly well that you would like to highlight?
I guess what worries me is what's going to happen to the people in countries who are less able to deal with this. As Kathy said, the U.S. has a very strong public health system, and the European countries do too. What about the rest of the world? What about those countries that have less robust public health systems or don't have the financial wherewithal to deal with the crisis? What's going to be done for them? And what happens in the U.S. on the economy to people who are already kind of on the margin? What happens to all those hot dog vendors and manicurists and street vendors, people who have service jobs, bartenders, people who are already struggling right now to make it? So when their business dries up, who's going to take care of them? So I worry about what's going to happen to those least able to deal with it, both peoples and countries. On the bigger theme, as Kathy was saying, that this is an interesting point to see whether the world is going to become more collaborative and cooperative, whether we'll get back to an international response, or whether it's going to drive nationalism further, whether countries will come out of this having learned that they need to rely on themselves more than others. So we don't know how it's going to come out.
That's it for our episode today. Many thanks to Ambassador Stevens and Mr. Tokola, and to you listeners for tuning in. Despite the social distancing policy in practice in Washington, D.C., the staff at KAI have been looking closely at how COVID-19 is affecting Korea and the wider global economy. We highly recommend you read Senior Director Troy Stangerone's recent piece in The Diplomat magazine on South Korea's preparations for the economic challenges that are expected to stem from the global pandemic. You can find the link to that article in the description of this episode. We'll be back next week with more commentary and analysis. See you then.